day, everyone. Welcome to the Citi-hosted Market Insights on Community Development, Freddie Mac Economist Perspective Conference. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, for opening remarks, I'd like to turn things over to Mark Dean. Please go ahead, sir.
Next, Steve. Good morning, everybody. This is Mark Dean from Citi Community Capital. Welcome to our third quarter edition of the Market Insights on Community Development. I think a number of you have participated in these in the past, but I'm Mark Dean. I head up the debt platform at Citi Community Capital, and we're a broad provider of debt in the affordable housing industry. We provide, you know, construction debt, perm debt, investment banking. We provide debt through the agencies. So I think a majority of people on this call have acted with us in that capacity from time to time. This call is really intended to bring a different type of capital to our clients, what I like to consider to be intellectual capital. Most of you interact with us for economic capital. This is, we consider to be, an installment of economic capital. And we do a handful of these, 4 to 6 a year. I've had some on tax credits, on agency executions, a wide variety of things. We have found that there's been a lot of interest in getting an economic outlook as it pertains to the multifamily space and particularly the affordable space generally each year. So this year we have asked one of our capital partners, Freddie Mac, to join us in this call and provide an installment of intellectual capital relative to economic outlook. So next, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm joined today by Steve Guggenmos, who is a vice president at Freddie Mac. He leads the research related to national and local market conditions for Freddie Mac's multifamily business, develops and models quantitative approaches for a wide variety of things at Freddie Mac. Prior to joining Freddie Mac in 1997, he was a financial economist for the FDIC. He was a research assistant for the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight. He holds a master's degree in finance from George Washington University and an undergrad in economics from American University, and then a BA from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. As a Freddie Mac employee, he lives in Virginia with his wife and 3 kids. So, Steve, I know this is took a lot of time and energy to prepare this, and so thank you for joining us today. I'm going to cover a couple of next, please, just a couple of housekeeping comments. During the presentation, the caller lines will be muted. We will take question and answers a couple of ways during the webinar. At the end of the webinar, we'll have a Q&A session, which the operator will come back on, provide instructions about how to put yourself in a queue for a question. And so certainly we look forward and would be happy to get questions at the end of the session. And then if you're like me and you either have a burning desire to ask a question mid-presentation, or you're worried that you'll forget your question by the end of the presentation, is generally what happens to me, you can also send questions in during the session by emailing askcitycommunitycapital@citi.com. And we'll gather those questions and also deal with those in the Q&A period at the end of the session. So with that, Steve, I'll turn it over to you and have you kind of walk through your perspective on the multifamily market and the affordable market.
Great. Thanks, Mark, and thanks for having me. I'm excited to have the opportunity to speak to such a great group. I think the idea of this call is fantastic, and I'm happy to have the chance to participate. I'll jump through to page 7, which is the multifamily supply. So I think coming into this year, there's a number, and throughout the year, there's been a number of concerns about supply, about pricing, and where we are in the cycle, and then what all that means for affordability. And I will try to touch on those a little bit as I step through these. So I do start off with supply, and I think it's notable that people were bringing up for a while that multifamily was going above, you know, the 30-year going to a 30-year high in supply, above the long run average, and was that something that was healthy for the market? And this shows that certainly that is the case. And supply peaked or starts peaked in 2015 at 451, and have come in a little bit since then. But completions are continuing to pick up, and they'll pick up through this year, as this shows. And they're actually the starts numbers have gone up 2 years in a row above the long run average. And the last time that's happened was 1999 and 2000. And before that, it was during the period of the 1980s, basically, where the average during the 80s was actually 394,000. And I think that 394 is good context in addition to people thinking about the long-run average. And 394 is a big number relative to where we've been for a long, long time. And that's where maybe I look at the line on the chart that shows renter-occupied housing. And so that went up a little bit at the on the left-hand side of the chart, and then started coming in a little bit during kind of a period of stability for the multifamily market from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, and then it's been picking up ever since. And I think that provides appropriate context because I think most people don't look back as far as that, and they consider this period from the mid-1990s to mid-2000s as a period of stability, which it was a period of stability, but it was a period of stability during a time when renter households was declining. This was not millennials coming of age as they are now, or baby boomers coming of age. This was the Gen X population, which was a much smaller population, and so 300,000 units was about right for a shrinking to flat renter household population. And as you can see, that since 2008, or even a little bit before, the renter household population has been growing really remarkably, and I think that says that the demand is a big, maybe a bigger story here than the supply story. And I'll go through then to the next slide, where we look at the overall housing market, and we like to stress this at Freddie Mac, as if we're concerned about multifamily supply, we need to think about the overall housing market. And the green certainly shows that pretty well, which is the total number of completions for single family and multifamily. And you can see how that's, you know, generally been between 1 million and 1.5 million over this whole time period. But then the line that goes together with it that looks a little bit brownish on my screen is the ratio of completions overall in the market to households. And here you can see that that number bounces around a little bit, but it's been low and for a while now. And the straight line, which is the average of that line, is well above it of the actual right now. So completions relative to households in the housing market is very low, which suggests that we still need to build more in the housing market. And, I mean, so you see these two. One thing you don't see is the households, which is a part of this ratio. And during this time, the number of households in the United States went from 60 million up to 125 million. So to think that we should be delivering about the same amount of supply is definitely not the correct assumption. So then how much more do we need? We'll look at that on page 9. So here again, it's just kind of the right-hand side of that chart, and we see that we see again multifamily and single-family supply, and then we look at the long-run average of about 1.5 million units built per year. And in 2017, we're on the pace for about 1.2, I'd say, and so that puts us still 360,000 below what we would expect, just going to the long-run average. And that long-run average doesn't consider kind of the ratio to households and things like that, so it could be even higher. But just using these numbers here, 360,000 relative to what is being built is about a 30% increase. So certainly we think that more needs to be built. So that's a lot on supply, and if there's some demand out there, just thinking about the fundamentals of it, on page 10, where we look at price appreciation, so I've been making the case that demand has been exceeding supply. If demand exceeds supply, we would expect to see prices go up. And we have a few things to look at in the housing market. We have single-family house prices, multifamily house prices, and we would have multifamily rents, and I will get to that further in the presentation. But here, certainly since 2012, as shown here, single-family house prices have gone from coming out of the recession and being, you know, a little bit negative to starting to grow and continuing to grow at about a 5% pace per year, and multifamily during this period growing generally in the range of 10 to 15%. And it's on pace right now. I think the annual pace is about 7.8%, I think, according to RCA. So I think everybody knows the story on rents, which, as I said, we'll get to, but rents have certainly been increasing. So for those that are, you know, as people get concerned and say, where are we in a cycle? Are we starting to turn down? I think we would need reason to think so, both from just looking at supply and demand and then looking at how prices come out in the market. And when prices in general are going up, that would still suggest that that demand is exceeding supply. But given that, I'll move to page 11 and say, okay.
Hey, so Steve, it's Mark. Just before you move on, I mean, because I know, you know, certainly within financial institutions, you know, ours included, you know, people get a little bit concerned about, you know, the number of cranes in the air, and they look at this from to some degree from a supply standpoint, not so much the demand, and that's where your last few slides have been really helpful in terms of the demand side. But so Freddie is bullish on multifamily, and this, I think this might be a little bit further in the presentation, but you're not particularly concerned about the disintermediation of multifamily by an improving single-family market?
No, I think there's enough demand in the housing market overall that, I mean, I think the, by some measures, right, there's still in the range of 3 million pent-up households. So that are, yeah, and this is the 25 to 34-year-old age cohort. When you look at typical propensity to form a household and compare what's happening today to what's been happening in the past, we would expect to have a little bit higher household formation, and not just a little bit, I guess, but quite a bit higher household formation. So I think that as the housing market, as supply comes on, I think people are going to find ways to form households, and I think there is a desire to form households. It's just been delayed, and I think part of that is delaying marriage, delaying forming families, and that kind of thing. And but these households we would expect still to be formed, and I think that most of them will rent before they buy. So we do continue to think that people will buy, that people want to buy. We're not assuming in Freddie Mac multifamily that it's turning over to a renter nation. And I'll speak to the home ownership rate a little bit later. But we do think that households will continue to be formed. They'll probably be formed first in the rental market, and then they'll move on to the housing market after that, and that there's a fair amount of pent-up demand.
Great.
Still.
Thank you.
Yep. So I had spoken about the property prices, and so that's one that's worth a little bit deeper dive because, as we know, prices have been going up in the mid-teens range since basically 2010, and to see a run like that is certainly a very strong run for the multifamily market, and it's reasonable to consider, are those prices justified? And so, like I said, one thing is to look back to the fundamentals. Another thing is to look at kind of premiums that are in that. And so in this chart, we show in blue, again on page 11, the treasury rate, and then in green, the rest of the spread up to the cap rate. and show that over time together with the price index, which is in the line. And so right now the treasury rate is just about 2.15, 2.16, and the last reported monthly cap rate from RCA was about 5.5, just a little bit inside of that, which is actually a little bit lower than third quarter of last year, and I think it's the only commercial property type where cap rates have come in over the last year. But that still leaves a spread of 332 basis points and between the cap rate and the treasury rate. And the 330 basis points in comparison to history is still wide, and so investors are still getting a premium greater than they would on average. And so for context, going back to 1990, the average is about 275 basis points. And the life insurers have a historical series that goes back to 1965 on the investments they've made. And in that series, the really long run average is 215 basis points. So certainly there, I think there's room for the cap rate spread to tighten. As we think about it, as rates go up, and it's easiest maybe to look at it and think about it in terms of a leveraged investor, if mortgage rates were to go up in the range of 50 basis points, we think that leads to about a 20 basis point increase in the cap rate, in order for the operator to get the same return on the property. At the same time, when we do an economic analysis and we look at the effect of strengthening markets, so if the employment growth rate is growing at about 1% a year, we think that makes downward pressure on the cap rate in the range of 20 basis points. So we're going to have these offsetting effects. In the end, we'll end up in a spread range that's probably inside of where we are right now, so there's some tightening to be done. But I think when people ask, are we comfortable with this low of cap rates, we are, and we get there based on a number of different analyses like those I've quoted. Going through, so we're in the debt market. I'll go through to page 12. And speak a little bit to something that's important to us, which is how many mortgages will be out there in any given year to be originated. The reason I do this chart right here is for us, we do analyses to say, okay, how much refinancings do we think are coming up at maturity, and how much new construction is there, and how much do things roll in any given year. And we try to use that to get to an overall level. Really, a more reliable method for us is just to look at how property prices have performed. And so coming out of that property price graph, when property prices are going up, as I said, in the mid-teens every year, we expect significant increase in mortgage originations because property owners are incented to take leverage out and probably put it into a new investment. And that is certainly what we've seen. And so I think there's been some question as to does the market continue to grow? And based on what we're seeing, we do think it continues to grow. And just as property prices probably won't grow in the mid-teens this year, we don't have our growth rate for mortgage originations in 2017 growing at double digits, but we do have it growing in the range of 5%. So I thought I would just touch on that. And then, you know, thinking about on page 13, how that works out for the overall market is so debt is growing and property prices are growing. So are we getting more leveraged as an industry? On page 13, we look at kind of a market level LTV. So on a property, we would have the loan amount in the numerator and the property price or value in the denominator to get to the LTV. Here, we get mortgage debt outstanding in the industry relative to an aggregated property price in the industry. And here we see the National Multi Housing Council actually has a methodology of getting to the overall price, which is where we get that. And so Here you can see that we're in the range of a 33% LTV in the market. So basically the pace of price appreciation is certainly enough to make up for the additional loans that are being made. And I think this is important, again, looking at a little bit longer time series here, is I think anybody that's been in the market over the last 20 years, 20, 30 years, knows that the market's moved from something that was kind of an arm's length transaction and things kind of, you know, mom and pops and something together with local lenders to something that's a much more institutionalized market and many more players and just every part of the process, I think, in multifamily lending has become more institutionalized and more professional. And I think that what you would expect in an industry maturing like that is an increasing LTV. And the fact that we're actually at a 33% number right now, which is relatively low, as you can see on the chart, is somewhat suggesting that even as things kind of stabilize, we would expect to see more borrowing in this market. And probably, you know, when we're at something like a 33%, we can certainly be comfortable with more as well. As a comparison, we would think that the single-family market might be in the, you know, low to mid-40s. So we may not get all the way up to those levels on a long-run average, but we certainly should move in that direction, I think. I've talked about a number of different things, and I think one thing that I just wanted to something of a plug in terms of thinking about where we are in the cycle and what we think about the market at any given point in time. We've created this index called AIMI, the Apartment Investment Market Index, which kind of layers together how property prices are moving relative to incomes on a property. And it considers that for a leveraged investor. So,
Steve, it's Mark. I'm going to interject just for a moment here because
sure. If
people have been listening with one ear on this and one ear doing something else, this is probably something that's worthy of both of your ears. This is a really interesting tool that can be relatively micro in its, you know, market look and approach. So, you know, if you were multitasking, this might be a good time to give us your full attention because this is really a great tool that Freddie Mac has.
Thank you. It's a simple little tool too. So I think fairly understandable, but I'm happy to discuss it with people as they have questions. But it's based on something that might be like a single family affordability index and looking at whether it's a good time to buy for people. This one is looking at kind of from an investment perspective, is it kind of expensive now or is it relatively cheap and how does it compare to history? And so we encourage people to look at either the national or the markets that we cover, which is in the range of 10 to 15 markets right now based on the data available to us. And it looks at where does this market stand relative to its history in terms of what you're paying for the cash flows on a property. So I compare it to maybe the stock market where years ago it may have, you know, it's clearly would have been a great time to get into Apple, you know, 5 years ago. The price has gone up a bunch since, but so you wish you would have been back then. But what your real question is what do things look like now? And so this gives us an opportunity to kind of layer together the cash flows that you can make on a property relative to its pricing, recognizing that you're going to be a leveraged investor. So the leveraged investor part will just capture the changes in the mortgage rate. So to the extent the mortgage rate goes down, the index will go up. To the extent that the mortgage rate goes up, the index will come down. But then it'll look at, you know, the net operating income on a property relative to what you're paying for it and seeing how expensive it is relative to history. And what we do right now is we look back and we say, what's a comparable period, kind of pre-recession? And I think if people, so to me, if the number is 2007 or 2008, that would probably give people a little bit of pause. and there might be some concern about that. Right now, when we look at it, it actually generally goes back to the 2004 period and sometimes into 2005. And I think that we all think, as it relates to the multifamily market, that that's actually a pretty decent place to be. So there can be lots of things to kind of put together, and certainly when you do an analysis related to any individual property or submarket or anything, you would get into a lot more detail than this. But what I like about this is looking at it across time in either nationally or for a specific market. I've spoken a fair amount about the demand side, so this shows renter households again on page 15. It also shows the home ownership rate. Certainly we've gone from the 69.5% range to the 63.5% range. We get questions, as I suggested before, about kind of directionally where is that going, is the nation changing, and do we just start to tick up kind of from here in the home ownership rate? Certainly it's been a big drop, and that has been very meaningful to the market. I think the most meaningful information that I have on this is there was a journal, the Cityscape Journal, that a little while back had a bunch of different folks, the Urban Institute, it had demographers at the University of USC in California and University of Arizona, take a look and see what they thought about home ownership rates in 2020, 2030, and one of them even took a crack at 2050. And certainly, I'm sure everybody would want to discount what's said about 2050. So many things can change. But I think it's informative to think about each of these. And one thing was that it was just robust across the different participants who looked at these with a little bit different approaches. And the 2020 numbers were generally in the 61.5% to 62% range homeownership rate. And the 2030 numbers then came into the 60 to 61% range, some a little bit lower than that. And then the 2050 number, the one that was put out there, was a 55% number, which can seem pretty shocking. The way I like to think about it is think about what their drivers were that were inside of that, and they looked at one would be whether the population was urban or rural, and they looked at housing affordability, and they looked at ethnicity, and they looked at age of population and all of those things. And when they cut across all those in the forecasted demographics, which can be relatively knowable, they all came to these declining numbers. And the 55, as trying to get context for that, is I looked at state-level homeownership rates, and California, as of the 2010 census, had a 54 to 55% homeownership rate. And so if you think that the country would start to look more like California in terms of high housing costs and ethnically diverse and urban and things like that, then you can see how these numbers kind of come in. But that, again, creates overall demand. And I just quickly, here's the vacancy rate and effective rents. And the history is well known to people, I suppose. The important thing here, I think, is I show the forecast, and this one's from Reis. We have our own forecasts that are not too dissimilar from this, probably a little bit stronger. Although vacancy rates move up a little bit faster, but rent growth continues to grow fairly strong. And we have Axiometrics, we have other sources. I think as we address concerns internally from credit risk folks as to where, you know, will this continue for multifamily, I think an important thing was we looked across all, like you said, Mark, there's a lot of people who bring up the cranes, and we have to address those concerns. But then you look at anybody who's exploring the market right now and giving their forecast for 2018, 2019, and again, 2020 might be a little bit far out, but and everything generally is growing, and growing generally faster than the pace of inflation. So it may not be the 5 to 10 to plus, depending on where you are, rental growth rates that we've seen in the past, but it is pretty healthy. And I think that's generally the case, and that's supported by the supply and demand, the move in the home ownership rate, all of those things. And it's a huge support overall for the pricing in the market as well. I think internally, when people ask about, you know, how house prices fell in the past and that people weren't forecasting those things, I think it's really important to say that in the commercial real estate and apartments, we actually have those cash flows that the pricing is based on, and we'll track those first and look for any indicators. And people are looking at that and generally continuing to see growth. This again, the only, I think, additional data point here is 2030 and showing that renter households continue to grow. So the story kind of continues. What happens? So then on page 18, what's happening with rents versus income? And here we start to move into the affordability study. And it's not been good, right? So rents are growing and incomes are not. And you can see indexing them to the same period in 2000, they are on either side of the x-axis, and that's going to create problems for the housing market. And on page 19, we can see that. And we generally do it with government data, and we pull, you know, American Community Survey, other types of information, and we try to, you know, categorize households. And here you can see that the affordability is falling. We had 55% of homes affordable to very low, or the VLI falling from 55.5 to 43.2 on kind of a national level from 2010 to 2015. I'll just skip through to page 20, where I think we can move away from kind of the market level averages. And we were able to take a look at our own business, and instead of having to worry about what geographies are defined or whether this was a survey and whether the sample was right and all that, we looked at our own business and we looked at whether we could count units as very low income or not. And we actually, during the period from 2010 to 2016, have a number of units that we financed twice. And so we get an actual unit-to-unit comparison. And so was a unit affordable the first time that we financed it? And we work hard to find those affordable units. And 11.2%, you can see here on page 20, what counted as VLI, 11.2% of the 97,000 units that we financed two times were affordable to very low-income households with the first financing. The second financing, again, just over this 2010 to 2016 period, and it wouldn't necessarily be a loan financed in 2010 and then one in 2016, it would often be a shorter period than that, was 4.3% affordable to very low income. So given the fact that this is exact unit to exact unit and over a relatively short period, this shows that change, that where the rent growth is growing so much faster than income, and income actually on a real basis kind of declining. And we're seeing that that is truly having an effect on how rental units are counted and how it's affecting the folks living in those units. And so that's the national level number. Going down to some of the states underneath, I'll just jump down to Colorado as an example. The first time we financed some of those units, the units in Colorado, 32.4% of them counted as very low income. The second time around, 7.5%. Some of this certainly has to do with the assumptions that are written into law and how people count very low income, assuming that people spend 30% of their income on rents or housing. And to the extent that a state, that a place changes and they no longer spend in the range of 30%, that's going to drop dramatically, which I think is part of what we're seeing there. And then in California, a relatively high cost place, originally 2.3, counted as very low income. The second time around, actually 2.5%. It increased a little bit, but really the story there is that number's flat, that it's basically the same, and it's almost nothing. Almost nothing counts as very low income because housing costs are so high there. And in fact, the ones that have no count, that don't count for very low income or median income as affordable, was 26.6% the first time around and 60.6% the second time around. And so this is a very granular look. Unit for unit, are things, you know, how are things changing for people on the ground? And this is showing that it's changing in a really meaningful way. So I'll wrap it up with that. I'll say the that does make it so it makes it harder and harder to make our affordable housing goals. We have to take different approaches. This is actually part of our comment to our regulator, FHFA, and that is a public comment. People want to see the broader document, and we'll probably put this into a paper and give more description of it in the future. But certainly from our conventional business in the past, getting units that just counted as affordable by nature of being relatively low rent places was over 90% of our business back in 2012, I believe. And in 2016, it's, I think, less than 45% of our affordable units come from the conventional business. And it shows the importance of growing our targeted affordable business, which will always have an ability to hit those needs, and then also growing our small balance loan program.
I know so, this is across your portfolio, but I think it's probably from our, you know, anecdotal and empirical experiences demonstrative of going across the market. And it's interesting because I know, you know, as a financier, we always worry about, if you will, organically affordable being a competitive product relative to, you know, targeted affordable. And, you know, this is eye-opening in that, you know, it's really not a competitor, and quite honestly, it's going away dramatically, at least in your experience.
Yeah, and I think it's troubling in what we learn about the overall market, that's for sure. And I think, but it is something that I think then it drives attention to this. And I think that, you know, like you said, what we can do with in terms of the conventional debt market is relatively limited. And I think that it points to the importance of looking for solutions in different ways.
It's interesting. It was for a different reason. You know, we looked at some of our Freddie Mac statistics, and Freddie's has some really good programs, both in the targeted affordable and, you know, what I'll call organically affordable or workforce housing. I would suggest, you know, our observations is you guys are, you know, along with us, kind of industry leaders in that. So, you know, hopefully some of those efforts will reverse some of these disturbing disintermediations of organically affordable.
Right. Yeah. And so just also to you reminded me as you said that this data is for, you know, 97,000 units. So certainly we do a whole lot more units than this. And so is this representative? As a part of this, we took all of our properties and trended them with just market level rent growth rates and got very similar effects. We did kind of validate this against other measures. And like you said, you've done analysis. I think we can look at, you know, the recent worst case needs came out recently from HUD. The Joint Center always has great information and others as well. There's many different ways to look at it. This one we just think is so relevant to our business, and it is, I think, consistent with what others find.
Hey, Steve, why don't you advance to the slide with our contact information on it? And then, operator, okay. I'm going to ask you to just go through the instructions and for the audience to ask questions.
Certainly, at this time, if you do have a question, that will be star 1. A voice prompt will indicate once your line has been opened to ask your question. And again, star 1 for questions here on the phone.
And we did get one, Steve, that we'll wait to see if we have anything on the phone line. But one of the people in the audience wanted to know, you talked about household formation, and specifically if you have thoughts on just kind of macro wage and income growth and its impact on household formation.
So I think that is so that will be the driver, I think. I think for so long you know, people refer to this recovery as it may not be the strongest recovery ever coming out of the Great Recession compared to other recessions, but at this point it is the longest recovery ever. But the notable part of that recovery is that wages have not kind of picked up as quickly. And I think finally in the last year the wages have picked up to some extent. But I don't have a forecast of that myself. But I agree with the person with the question is like, is, you know, that is the driver, I think, in terms of forming new households. And I think that there's a divide, right? I think that people that are coming out with good skills right now are coming out with a college degree and sometimes with student debt, which often gets mentioned. And those people actually are still competent enough to rent and or own and form households. And I think that right now the question will be for the broader, you know, market as a whole, whether everybody can kind of get to that same level. And I don't have a good feel for when that happens.
Great, thank you. Operator, any callers with questions?
Yes, we do have a couple questions. Caller, please go ahead.
Yes, wonderful presentation. Where do we get a copy of all the slides?
Steve, we need to make sure that we can do this with you, but we generally will have this posted on the City Community Capital website within a couple of days of the webinar.
Great, very, very good presentation. I thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm completely comfortable with the presentation being posted.
And we'll take our next caller.
Yeah, that was a great presentation. I know one of the things that, you know, a lot of folks on this call think about is, you know, they're very focused on affordable housing. But can you kind of, you know, compare and contrast the demand for, you know, Class A, Class B, Class C versus affordable in terms of, you know, where the best opportunity lies? I mean, I think if you can get a deal structured and closed, it's clear that there's plenty of demand on the affordable side, but I know many folks kind of try to allocate capital to the very most attractive parts of the market and just want to get a sense of, you know, what the most attractive part might be.
Right. Yeah, I think so to me, I think that the data on this is a little bit tricky to get definitive kind of on both the supply and the demand and, you know, rents and vacancies and everything. But what is clear is that for going into, say, like the 2012 period, I think Class A vacancy rates were tighter than the others and that rent growth was generally viewed to be strong there. I think the Class A, you know, when we look at the supply that's come on, and we can look at it by market, and we can think about, you know, the gateway market's taking on tons of supply in some places. And certainly I think that where before that supply came on, the rent growth was very strong. It has fallen. I mean, I think I sometimes, you know, talk about the generalities of the multifamily market and talk about how much demand there is and find myself being very rosy. I do have to take a look and find the places where it has kind of pulled in a little bit, and I think that is Class A, and certainly you see that in New York, you saw it in the Bay Area, you see it a little bit in the D.C. area and other places. But what's been fairly robust through that period is Class B and Class C rents have held up pretty well. And I think it continues to be a compelling story there. And then and Class C, I think, was like 5 to 7% lower occupancy is in Class A years ago, and now it's actually, I think, even overall by the numbers that we look at. And so you would expect with that tightness that the that market will remain a fairly strong market for rent growth. And then in the affordable space, I think that there's just basically the demand cannot be met as evidenced by what we saw here. And so so that market, I think anytime there's units brought online, there those units will be taken up.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take our next question.
Hi. Thanks for a great presentation, good slides, and a great run-through. The case that seems to be made is a bullish one with, you know, demand outpacing supply and drivers that are, as you say, knowable as it relates to demographics, at least. What part of you, you know, the sort of the low probability, high severity events, what part of you is concerned about disrupting this sort of longer term bullish outlook? You know, is it recession? Is it a spike in interest rates? And, you know, even if those are shorter term, do you see the long run bullishness continuing?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we actually, certainly, there was a slide up front on what I did, and Mark did a nice job of covering that. And certainly my job going back a long ways has been kind of on the credit risk side here and looking at, and building models to perform kind of debt performance. And you are asking a question that I answered in that capacity in the past year by our board of directors, so in good company. And the question they wanted, I think, don't give me, you know, an increase in mortgage rate, of rates of 1%. I want a real increase. And so I think the scenario, and so they asked it to be run of the whole company, single family and multifamily. And so they said, okay, I want rates to go up, you know, in the range of like 400 basis points, over the, you know, foreseeable future. And we pushed up rates, I think very nearly 200 basis points the first year, another 100 basis points each of the next 2 years, and that scenario was looked at by and created additional economic indicators, or our chief economist's office created economic indicators that went together with that, and we looked at and so certainly 400 basis points over a period of like 3 years is a meaningful stress. And it certainly had an impact on cap rates. And so, like I say, we generally expect cap rates to go up in the, you know, together with treasuries with a little bit of a buffer there. But at the same time, when we dropped this scenario into our models for rent and vacancies, given where we are right now with such tight markets, and I'd say we've talked a little bit about the national vacancy rate. When we look across all the metros, like so 79 metros captured by Reis, 75% of those markets still have vacancy rates lower than the long-run average. So they're still relatively tight markets. So we put in a scenario where rates go up, and the models generally think that inflation goes with that, and then with tight multifamily occupancy, that then turns into rental growth. And so the overall effect for the multifamily market was instead of, price appreciation going up in the range of 5 to 7%, we had it falling like 5% 1 year. And so that is a turn. So a very major in the shock turns the market by by about 10% from plus 5 to minus 5. When we run that through and look at it relative to, say, like LTVs in our book of business or, you know, a little bit longer-term performance and run-out loans for the rest of their life, it's actually not that drastic. It didn't produce tons and tons of losses like you might think of if you look back to certainly not comparable to the late 80s, early 90s multifamily market performance, nor, you know, what CMBS would have experienced, you know, in the last recession. It was relatively benign, and I think the message of that was just, again, what you said. It takes a shock to two things, I think. So to me, yes, there are scenarios where things go bad, but I think with where the market stands right now, I think it takes a shock, you know, to interest rates and to the economy. And I certainly predicting the probability of those kind of events is difficult because it's pretty remote. But I do think it really at this point. We had a bit of a move in rates at the beginning of the year, that 1%, and the markets kind of performed pretty well post that. We consider this more extreme one, and it looks in general where in that one as well, rents were slow for a period and then kind of picked up. But I think it takes a couple of things. I think it takes a recession and higher rates, so a little bit of stagflation.
Steve, moving along to another question that's somewhat tangential that came across the email, is how would immigration reform affect the answers that you've given?
That's an excellent question, and this is another one that gets a little bit hard to forecast, but I do think that immigration certainly benefits the housing market, and so any pullback on that would certainly lower demand for housing, and to the extent that it's sizable, that would have an impact. I just think about those demographic studies that were done by the different demographers and academicians, and they do not layer in a huge amount of migration to get to those results. And there are different scenarios that are provided by the Census Bureau, and there's certainly weakness. And I'm sorry, I don't remember off the top of my head how much it changes something like that. But we are not fully reliant on immigration for overall demand, but it certainly plays a meaningful role.
Great, thank you. Operator, do we have any more callers with questions?
Once again, that is star one for any further questions at this time.
And I'm going to maybe begin the process. We'll keep that line open for a moment, but begin the process to kind of wrap this up because we always try to keep it within about an hour. So it's a lunch break for our friends on the East Coast. So Steve's contact information is included within the PowerPoint. I would also say for those of you who can't get enough Google Moss, which is I'm one of those, he is also a YouTube star. And Freddie Mac has a wealth of information on their website, which I think the information is provided in our presentation, as well as, Steve just recently posted a video on YouTube on related matters. So certainly you can get more analysis there. If you could advance to the last slide that talks about being able to where they can obtain a copy of the presentation on our website. I'd also ask, there's a link to feedback. It's always appreciated to get feedback on the value of this this specific conversation or the series that we have across the year. We always welcome feedback on that. And, again, want to thank both our capital partner at Freddie Mac, and our intellectual partner at Freddie Mac for taking the time to prepare the presentation, give us very thoughtful, concise information. It's always when you talk about a webinar with to talk about the economic outlook, that can always be an interesting, challenging presentation. And Steve, I think you did a fabulous one. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I enjoyed it. And as you said, I'm happy to be contacted and speak more about these topics to folks that are interested.
And your contact information is in there. Ours is in there. Certainly just even go to our website to download this in a day or so. I want to thank everybody in the audience. We had, I think, in excess of 350 people participate today, so that's great. That helps us understand that people think this is valuable. So thank you for taking the time out of your day to participate. Thank you for the business that you do with Freddie Mac and with Citigroup. With that, we will there's also in the link, there's a place to subscribe to, I think, our webinar update information. So if this is your first one and you got this from a friend, if you want to email that link, we will make sure you get notices of future webinars. So with that, I wish everybody a good day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That does conclude today's conference. Again, thank you all for joining us.